You're listening to the Monetary Blog from the FOMC Insight Engine. This is the offset. What the Fed's own transcripts reveal about the fiscal burden Judy Shelton describes. On the Sunday before Kevin Warsh's Senate Banking Committee confirmation hearing, Judy Shelton published an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal. The following morning, she appeared on CNBC's Squawk Box to extend the argument. The timing was not incidental. Shelton, senior fellow at the Independent Institute, former Trump Fed board nominee, author of Good as Gold, was not simply commenting on monetary policy. She was defining the intellectual framework Warsh would carry into the hearing room, articulating the questions senators might ask and the terms in which a new Fed chair should answer them. When the person who might have been a Fed governor writes the op-ed the week before the confirmation hearing of the person who will be Fed chair, the document is something closer to a policy brief than a newspaper column. The argument she made across both appearances has a recognizable shape. Congress spends freely. The Federal Reserve responds by raising rates, and it is private borrowers, small businesses without capital markets access, households without refinancing options, who absorb the adjustment cost they did not cause. The Fed, in this account, is the instrument through which fiscal excess is converted into economic pain, distributed unevenly, concentrated in the sectors least able to substitute. She went further. The 2% inflation target was not a considered policy conclusion, but an informal institutional drift, begun under Janet Yellen's influence and ratified publicly only in 2012, a departure from the zero inflation mandate she attributes to Alan Greenspan, and to the July 1996 FOMC transcripts she invites the viewer to read for themselves. These are testable claims. Shelton names a specific transcript, a specific mechanism of harm falling on specific borrowers, and a specific prescription for constraining the Fed's capacity to purchase government debt without limit. The first two have left direct traces in the documentary record the institution generated for itself. The third, the specific institutional design of purchase caps, is engaged here only indirectly. The archive speaks to the internal debate over what Treasury purchases were and what they risked, but does not resolve whether a formal statutory limit of the kind Shelton implies would have altered the fiscal consequences she describes. We went into the archives. The complaint inside the room. The first test the archive poses is whether Shelton's core diagnostic claim has any institutional basis at all. Her argument that the Fed tightens to cancel inflation Congress generates and that the private sector absorbs the adjustment reads, on its surface, as the kind of populist simplification that serious monetary economists dismiss. The expectation, opening the transcripts and staff memos, is refutation. What the record delivers is more ambiguous. Not a systematic institutional endorsement of Shelton's specific causal chain, but a body of internal deliberation in which officials acknowledged fiscal-monetary conflict, worried about accommodation perceptions, and voiced frustration about deficits as inflationary drivers, while the dominant institutional self-description remained grounded in mandate language about aggregate demand and inflation expectations rather than fiscal offset rhetoric. Shelton frames the problem with pointed directness. Do we punish the small business owners who can't get access to capital with high rates when the inflation is really caused by the fiscal overspending of Congress? But now we're set up to where the Fed counteracts that by imposing high interest rates on the private sector. The archive contains voices that resonate with parts of this framing, particularly the recognition that fiscal policy creates inflationary pressure the Fed must respond to, without confirming the specific mechanism she describes. Robert P. Mayo, president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago, illustrated the fiscal-monetary tension in 1979, though from the opposite direction. Not the tightening Shelton describes, but the accommodation the institution felt compelled to permit. From the Robert P. Mayo, the Federal Reserve System had to permit more rapid monetary expansion than it felt desirable. Otherwise, the increased public debt could not be successfully financed in a free market without squeezing private credit mercilessly. Mayo's formulation is precise. The alternative to accommodating the deficit was squeezing private credit. The institution chose accommodation. The cost of that choice fell on the private sector regardless, either through inflation that eroded purchasing power or through direct credit displacement. Shelton's framing compresses this into a single grievance, but the underlying mechanism is Mayo's. John J. Ballas, president of the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco, calculated the inflationary contribution of deficit financing in the same period at a full percentage point or more added to the basic rate of inflation, a figure that made the fiscal monetary transmission not just qualitative, but measurable. The internal acknowledgement intensified across decades rather than fading. By 2011, Richard W. Fisher, president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas, named the institutional risk in terms the Public Communications Office would never have approved. From the Richard W. Fisher: "By this action, we have run the risk of being viewed as an accomplice to Congress's fiscal nonfeasance. To avoid that perception, we must vigilantly protect the integrity of our delicate franchise." Accomplice. The word is Fisher's, not Shelton's. That the institution felt compelled to defend against the perception reveals the seriousness of the concern. But the record also contains explicit internal efforts to distinguish LSAPs from debt monetization. Dennis Lockhart articulated the criterion directly. Monetization, properly understood, would mean tying purchases to new Treasury debt issues as a mechanism for enabling deficit financing, a narrower definition than the scale-based concern Fisher was voicing. Narayana Kochalakota framed large-scale asset purchases differently still, as a maturity structure transformation in which the Fed exchanged long-duration obligations for short-duration reserves, a characterization that kept the operation within the conceptual space of monetary rather than fiscal action. William Dudley drew the sharpest line. The relevant distinction was not whether market participants perceived accommodation, but whether the purchases compromised the Fed's capacity to pursue its mandate independently of fiscal pressure, a question he answered in the negative. These were not merely rationalizations offered to the public. They were the terms in which a significant portion of the committee understood its own actions. On the balance sheet question, Shelton's second claim, that unlimited Treasury purchases functionally enable the deficit cycle, a 2013 staff memo identified an additional dimension the institution was reluctant to surface publicly. Analyzing the fiscal consequences of inflation surprises under LSAP-era balance sheet expansion, the FOMC Secretariat staff wrote, from the FOMC Secretariat staff: "However, there is another fiscal benefit of the higher inflation that arises from what we might call a surprise inflation tax. The institution's own analysts were tracing the fiscal consequences of inflation surprises under LSAP-era balance sheet expansion, including the reduction of the real debt burden. While public communications described Treasury purchases as neutral portfolio balance operations, that analytic work sat alongside a genuine and unresolved internal disagreement. Fisher and Plosser saw the purchases as functionally crossing into fiscal territory. Lockhart, Kochalakota, and Dudley saw them as defensible monetary operations conducted through secondary markets with clear mandate justification. The gap between what staff documented and what leadership projected externally is among the widest in the record." Shelton's diagnosis draws on the Fisher-Plosser strain of that internal debate, which was real and seriously argued, but it was contested from within the same institution, by participants working from the same archive, who reached different conclusions about what the purchases were and what they risked. That internal agreement, however, is borrowed authority, and borrowed authority has original holders. The Greenspan-era precedents Shelton explicitly invokes to anchor her prescriptions require a different kind of scrutiny. The institution that confirmed her diagnosis did not arrive at her conclusions. The transcript she cites: The archive confirmed Shelton's core fiscal monetary diagnosis, but confirmation of the diagnosis is not confirmation of the historical lineage she constructs around it. Shelton anchors her argument in a specific archival claim. If you read the transcripts from July 1996, you'll see that he interpreted the mandate for promoting stable prices as meaning zero inflation. This is not paraphrase or inference. It is an assertion about what a specific document contains. The July 3, 1996 transcript is in the archive. Greenspan's statement at that session does establish price stability as his governing objective. What follows, however, forecloses the reading Shelton offers. From the Alan Greenspan, "My own view, as I have stated many times, is that our goal should be price stability. If you force the price level down, you induce real reallocations of resources, because to stay in business, firms have to achieve real, as distinct from nominal, efficiencies. That phenomenon is what price stability means to me, and I see it as a very complex issue." This is not a statement of zero inflation targeting. It is an argument against deflation, against forcing the price level down, anchored in a functional definition. Price stability, in Greenspan's framing, is the state where inflation no longer distorts resource allocation. He is defining the concept by its economic effects, not by a fixed number. The same session contains the analytical core that makes Shelton's reading untenable. Staff work on CPI measurement bias. Estimates ranged from 0.5 to 1.5 percentage points of upward overstatement had informed the committee's deliberations, and Greenspan absorbed its logic fully. He made the arithmetic explicit. Reaching price stability was achievable either by reducing actual inflation or by correcting the CPI's measurement error, with the two routes producing equivalent outcomes. Measured inflation of 1 to 2%, given known overstatement, was already operationally equivalent to true price stability. Literal zero measured inflation was not the goal. It was a misreading of the goal. By February 1997, he extended this reasoning to the index itself. From the Alan Greenspan, "Those who are making economic judgments, including the staff here, are beginning to move away from the CPI as a reliable measure or goal of inflation. So when we talk about our price objectives, I hope we will not lock ourselves into that index." The CPI had become, in his words at that same session, increasingly a political number and less an economic one. The committee registered this. The internal consensus that low positive measured inflation constituted price stability, given known measurement error, was settled in deliberation well before any public articulation. For 16 years, opportunistic disinflation language filtered out the measurement bias nuance that gave the committee's internal position its coherence. The gap between the internal and the public register was real and consequential, but it does not support Shelton's account of what the internal position was. The authority she borrows rejected the position she attributes to him. If Greenspan's argument was that measured inflation of 1 to 2% already constituted effective price stability, because the CPI overstated true inflation by precisely that margin, then the 2% target was broadly consistent with important elements of his framework. Though later inputs, zero lower bound insurance and expectations anchoring, extended well beyond his original measurement bias logic. The question is no longer whether Shelton has read Greenspan correctly. It is how that target actually came to be, and whether the process that produced it resembles the quiet institutional coup she implies. The target they built together.
Shelton's account of the 2% target assigns it a single architect and a single decisive influence. Only later, under the influence of Janet Yellen, that the Fed unofficially said 2%, and they didn't dare say that out loud until 2012. The framing implies a quiet coup, a personal imposition, an institution too cautious to acknowledge what one governor had engineered. The documentary record tests this directly, and what it reveals is nearly the inverse. The technical case for 2% emerged from two intersecting streams of staff research that preceded Yellen's decisive period by years. The Boskin Commission's finding of a 0.9 percentage point upward bias in CPI measurement established the first input. Targeting zero measured inflation would mean engineering mild actual deflation. Staff work on the zero lower bound supplied the second. Once the policy rate approaches zero, the Fed loses conventional capacity to respond to downturns. Together, these findings produced 2% as an engineering solution, a number that emerged as increasingly defensible given converging analytical considerations: measurement bias, zero lower bound insurance, and expectations anchoring, before it became any single governor's signature issue. The Boskin work applied specifically to the CPI. By the time the committee formalized its target in 2012, the reference index had shifted to the PCE deflator, which historically runs somewhat below CPI inflation. The directional logic is preserved. The case for a positive measured inflation buffer held under either index, and the magnitude of the buffer remained analytically reasonable given PCE's own known limitations. Governor Ben Bernanke was advocating publicly for an explicit numerical range before he became chair. From the Ben Bernanke: "In my public remarks, I have occasionally referred to price stability as defined in terms of the core PCE deflator in a 1 to 2% range. I think maintaining some space between the zero lower bound and our interest rate is important, and I would be uncomfortable with a lower range that brings us to zero too frequently." Vice Chairman Donald Cohn built the coalition 2 years later using the same logic. From the Donald Cohn: "That concern led me to a CPI of at least 2%, which I think takes care of most of the zero bound problems." Cohn went on to urge the committee to reach consensus, language that describes persuasion assembling a framework, not a single voice imposing one. Yellen's own account from that same February 2005 session inverts Shelton's framing entirely. Describing the 1996 discussions where the number first crystallized, she noted that there was actually a considerable consensus among participants, including myself, for a 2% long-run objective for CPI inflation. She placed herself inside the consensus. Governors Meyer and Gramlich had pressed for numerical transparency in the late 1990s. Staff papers on nominal wage rigidity and zero lower bound risk operated independently of any single governor's advocacy. One cannot stage a coup when every faction agrees on the destination. The internal public gap here is temporal rather than analytical. The intellectual architecture was substantially complete by the early 2000s. What was missing was the political will to announce it. Shelton's "didn't dare say that out loud" exploits exactly that silence. The appearance of secrecy, where there was instead a long and broadly participatory process conducted away from public view. The 2% target survives the test of origin. It is analytically rigorous, institutionally consensual, and grounded in measurement science rather than ideology. The instrument through which it operates is a different matter. The policy rate is blunt. It moves the cost of borrowed money for every borrower simultaneously, without distinguishing between an investment bank with access to capital markets and the small business whose only credit is a local loan. Whatever the target's pedigree, what that tool does to the borrowers who have no alternative is the question the archive has not yet been asked to answer. The borrowers who cannot substitute. The question the archive has not yet been asked has its most human expression in the moment Shelton's voice broke on CNBC. Do we punish the small business owners who can't get access to capital with high rates when the inflation is really caused by the fiscal overspending of Congress? The historians of monetary policy can debate the 2% target's pedigree across years. The owner of a regional machine shop financed through a community bank does not have years. They have a credit line. The archive's answer is consistent across most episodes, though not without complication, and among its most uncomfortable findings. Not because the Fed was blind to the distributional asymmetry, but because it saw that asymmetry clearly across four decades and found itself without a durable tool to address it. The recognition begins in 1981 as the Volcker tightening moved through the economy. Willis J. Wynne, president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland, reported to the FOMC what regional contacts were telling him. Many of the small businesses are holding on, and as such, they're delaying or cancelling any orders for new equipment and delaying expansion. So we're going to get some secondary effect from this curtailment. Holding on is the language of a business with no alternative source of capital. Large corporations facing tightening can issue commercial paper, access bond markets, or draw on revolving credit at negotiated rates. Small businesses cannot. Governor J. Charles Partee named the mechanism in 1982. High interest rates had taken a particularly marked effect on smaller firms because they relied heavily on short-term credit. The reliance was structural, not a planning failure. When bank credit tightened, there was nowhere else to turn. That recognition persisted across the decades. Vice Chairman Roger Ferguson noted in 2001 that NFIB survey data might understate the severity of the problem. He expected that many risky small businesses had found credit harder or more expensive to obtain, even when aggregate measures appeared relatively benign. By 2011, Governor Elizabeth Duke named the structural outcome directly. There appears to be a bifurcation between the haves and the have-nots. Large companies have credit, small companies have not. 30 years after Wynne's regional contacts cancelled equipment orders, the structural fact was unchanged. Internally, the language stayed visceral across those decades. Firms holding on, credit bifurcated. Public communications absorbed the same distributional distress into aggregate language about cyclical conditions. The archive confirms Shelton's diagnosis. The policy rate is a blunt instrument, and small businesses without capital market access bear its sharpest edge. The sympathy her argument earns at this moment is legitimate. And then, Vice Chairman Frederick Henry Schulz, speaking in October 1981, offers a contemporaneous complication that cuts against the prescription Shelton implies. The problems facing small businesses were not related to takeover lending. They are not even caused in the most fundamental sense by high interest rates. Schulz's argument points toward inflation, driven by fiscal excess, as the fundamental cause, not rates themselves. That framing is not a concession to Shelton's prescription. It is a complication of it. If high inflation, rather than high rates, is the root cause, then the remedy is tighter monetary policy to suppress that inflation, not looser policy to ease the borrowing costs that inflation made necessary. The rate cut Shelton implies would not address the cause Schulz named. But the structural constraint the archive establishes does not rest on Schulz alone. What the record shows across four decades is that credit bifurcation between large and small borrowers persisted through both tightening and easing cycles. Conditions that should, on Shelton's account, have delivered alternating relief and pressure, but instead delivered a consistent pattern. Wynne's contacts were holding on under Volcker-era tightening in 1981. Ferguson's NFIB data showed small firms facing harder credit even when aggregate conditions appeared relatively benign in 2001. Duke's bifurcation finding arrived during the post-crisis accommodation of 2011.
The structural constraint is visible not only in Schulz's decomposition of causes, but in this persistence across 40 years of varying rate environments. Rate cuts, Shelton implies, would not solve the problem, even if they transmitted perfectly to the firms she names, because the problem outlasted every easing cycle the archive records. Followed to its logical conclusion, Shelton's argument arrives at a destination she does not name. The Fed's internal deliberations confirmed the distributional asymmetry she describes. They also confirmed, with equal consistency, that the conventional policy rate and broad asset purchases cannot address it selectively. Targeted lending facilities created under emergency authority, the 2020 Paycheck Protection Program Liquidity Facility, and the Main Street Lending Program, were explicitly designed to reach small businesses and their intermediaries, and they did so to a limited degree. But they were crisis instruments, legally constrained by the Federal Reserve Act's Section 13(3) requirements, dependent on Treasury capital backstops provided under the CARES Act, and terminated once the emergency authorization lapsed. They are not standing facilities available in normal policy environments, and their temporary existence reinforces rather than undermines the post's central constraint. Deploying them required congressional authorization and appropriated fiscal support. The same distributional failure operates in the opposite direction. In easing cycles, large-scale asset purchases transmitted to investment-grade borrowers, while the small firms Shelton defends remained beyond reach, a finding the archive delivered from the other side of the same asymmetry. The remedies capable of reaching small businesses directly, on a durable, structural basis, require action from the legislative body whose fiscal excess created the inflationary pressure in the first place. The argument that asks whether small businesses are punished for congressional overspending ends by demanding that Congress act. The archive documented that constraint 4 decades ago. The op-ed was timed. The interview extended it. And across both appearances, Shelton assembled a case that the archive confirms and contradicts in almost equal measure, more correct and more mistaken than it appeared on the Sunday before the hearing. She is not wrong about the disease. The fiscal-monetary conflict is real, and it is documented in the institution's own deliberations with a candor that never reached the public statements. FOMC members named it behind closed doors while projecting confidence outward. The complaint she brings from outside the building had already been voiced inside it. What the archive corrects is the lineage she constructs around that diagnosis. The transcript she cites documents Greenspan explicitly embracing a measurement offset, a technical adjustment to reported inflation, as the practical path to price stability, not a demand for the zero headline inflation she attributes to him. The 2% target she describes as Yellen's informal imposition was a multi-decade convergence, documented across successive chairmanships, ratified by international consensus long before 2012. The authority she borrows was already pointing in a different direction. And the harm she names, the small business owner paying 8%, the borrower without capital markets access, the voice on CNBC that caught, is real and is documented. The archive recorded staff economists modeling exactly that distributional asymmetry and finding no instrument to address it within the Fed's toolkit. The monetary offset of fiscal excess is a documented mechanism. The measurement offset Greenspan actually sought built the framework she misreads. The distributional offset that could protect the borrowers she defends was sought, modeled, and found missing. It never existed. The institution has known this for 40 years. This has been the Monetary Blog from the FOMC Insight Engine at causalityineconomics.com.